Okay, thanks very much. I have to say that while Jody gave a very generous and fulsome introduction of my accomplishments, she left out one very significant accomplishment, which is that she used to be my student, probably the one that I'm most proud of. Although it's a little intimidating now when I meet her students in the room. And also, it's a real pleasure to have this chance to discuss a topic which, as Jody mentioned, is very close to my heart, and also to be on the panel with Abhijit Banerjee, whose work has greatly influenced my thinking on this subject. And actually, what you're going to hear is somewhat complementary to what Abhijit just presented. Let me just start with the basics, which, again, Abhijit alluded to earlier, that we have been seeing these large increases in enrollment across the developing world, and particularly the low-income regions of the world in South Asia and Africa. But one thing just to keep in mind is that while there have been increases in enrollment rates, completion rates, which is the students dropping out of school, have not been increasing as rapidly. And you see these countries like Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea, where there's been a substantial increase in enrollment rates, falling behind on completion rates. This is true not just in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in South Asia. Look, in South Asia, the big celebration is this huge enrollment increase, but completion rates are really still awfully low, with the one exception of Sri Lanka, which happens to be my country. And we'll get back to that in a minute, because I'm going to try to show you that even that is somewhat illusory. The other is to go, if you unpack this completion rates a little bit, you also see some big gaps in gender. In Uttar Pradesh, which is one of the states of India, of course it's a state of 160 million people, so if it was an African country, it would be the largest African country. What you find in UP is that the richest 20% of the population, everybody goes to school, the girls and the boys, at the same rate. But for the poorest 40%, within the poorest 40%, the gender gap, the gap between girls and boys, is greater than the income gap. That a poor boy has the drop, if you're a poor boy, is less than the drop in completion rates if you're a poor girl relative to being a poor boy. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be the case even within South Asia. If you just go about 1,000 miles to the east, going across Abhijit's home state of West Bengal, and go to Bangladesh, what you find in Bangladesh is there's still an income gap, but there's no gender gap. The poor girls and poor boys, they go to school at much lower rates, but the rates are the same between boys and girls. And we'll get back a little bit to what that, why that's the case. In Africa too, you find some interesting anomalies, not necessarily about on gender, but also in the difference between access and completion rates. You've got a country like Malawi, where the access rate initially, the access to primary school between the richest and the poorest quintile, is about the same, 98% versus 94%. And then it starts deviating quite rapidly as you look at completion rates and access to secondary and upper secondary school. And this, again, this sort of fits with our intuition that kids all go to school and then the poorer kids drop out or don't fail to complete. What's interesting is that in Mali, there's a big gap even at the initial stage, at the access stage, where the poorest don't even go to primary school at anywhere near the rates as the richest do. And I think this has something to do also with the density of population. You know, Mali is a much more sparsely populated environment than is Malawi. And then finally, its completion is only part of the story, as Abhijit was highlighting earlier. The big gap seems to be learning outcomes. And if you look at the gap between access and access with literacy skills, which is the learning outcomes, first of all, there is a gap overall. This is the average gap on the left for DR Congo. But that gap is even wider for the poorest 20% of the population. So even within the 20% of the population, the learning outcomes fall way behind their school enrollment rates. Now, lest you think that this is only a phenomenon of low-income, fragile states like DR Congo, let me say that, and this was a surprise to me, even though I'm from Sri Lanka, I only learned this stuff when I was working in South Asia, that you have huge learning gaps in Sri Lanka. Remember, that was a country with the highest completion rate in South Asia. This was a survey that showed that something like only 37% of the children in primary school, on average, had a mastery of their own language, and about 38% had a mastery of mathematics, appropriate for primary school level. And only about 10% had a working knowledge of English. And you know, keep in mind, this is the best performing country in South Asia. And this came home to me once we were visiting a rural school in Sri Lanka, and we met the English teacher, and she couldn't speak a word of English. And so it's not at all surprising. And then the learning outcomes, as Abhijit mentioned, in India are also quite disturbing. Something like over 60% of the children could not read a sentence in their own language. This is the same Pratham Asar study that Abhijit pointed out. And about 50% couldn't do a two-digit subtraction problem. So, you know, Houston, we have a problem. A huge problem. And the thing that's disturbing is that we expect the rationale for government intervention in education is often around the idea that governments should be, the reason government intervenes in education is to make sure that poor people have access to education. It is an equity rationale that is underlying the whole role of government in education, and yet this is the group that is consistently being left out of the education process, and that's the real problem. There are clearly signs of government failure, I'm sometimes accused of being a right-wing Republican when I say that. I call it service delivery failures now. It goes over better at the World Bank, too. But let me just go through some of these. And again, Abhijit mentioned it. One of the reasons these children are not learning, as Abhijit also alluded to, is the absenteeism. But 25% of the time in Indian primary public schools, the teacher is not there. And the range is from about 15% to about 35% or 40% in the states of Bihar and Jharkhand. The distressing part of this is that it's very difficult to change this. You know, these experiments that Abhijit and his colleagues have been involved in, providing teacher incentives to try to improve, like the cameras and so on, to try to improve teacher presence, might work in the small. But try to introduce that as legislation. Try to make it a much more widespread factor, and it becomes extraordinarily difficult. And we have to face the fact that the reason there's this absenteeism is partly political. The teachers in many of these rural areas are also the political campaigners. They run the election campaigns of the politicians. And there is a compact there where the teacher gets a job for which they don't have to show up, in return for which they get the politician elected. It's even harder in Uttar Pradesh, in the state legislature of Uttar Pradesh, 20% of the members of the state legislature are teachers. And another 20% are former teachers. So you try to introduce legislation in that environment, it becomes very difficult. I can't resist, because sometimes when I present, I guess this hasn't happened recently, but maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, when we used to present this absentee results, people would say, well, that's because teachers aren't, the reason they're absent is because they're not well paid, right? Well, it turns out that, and this is getting back to the Pakistan study, the LEAP study that Abhijit mentioned, in fact, but it's also true in India, teachers are paid, public school teachers are paid about four times what the private school teachers, the dollar a day. Actually, I think it's a dime a day, so it's $3 a month, private schools in Punjab, at least. Dollar a month, yeah, I think it's $3 a month, anyway. But the other thing is, so the teachers, you can't say that the teachers are, the reason for the absenteeism is that teachers are underpaid. The other thing is that in the study in Pakistan, they also looked at what is the relationship between the amount teachers get paid and the degree of absenteeism. And what you find is that in private schools, teachers' pay goes down relative to the absentee rate, but in public schools, goes the other way, right? And this is partly because it's the more senior teachers, and sometimes the principal, who is the one who's absent most of the time. This is, in fact, not just an Indian or a South Asian phenomenon. This is exactly the same statistics that Abhijit put up in a bar chart. It's quite widespread. And just to give you that last line, Uganda, so in Africa, Uganda has a 27% rate of absenteeism, which is even higher. And when we came out with the study, the Ugandans got quite upset and decided to do something about it. I think they brought it down to about 22% now. But then there was a follow-on study that looked at what, when the teacher is present, the teacher is doing. Right? And that's when it gets really distressing, because within, conditional on teacher being present, only 18% of the time is the teacher in class teaching. Right? And about 20% of the time you couldn't find the teacher, even though officially they were recorded as being present. 34% of the time out of class in school, I have no idea what they're doing, and so on. And let me just come back to this point about the politics. Again, I used to think when I was working in South Asia that it was the South Asian teachers that were very powerful politically for the reasons I just mentioned. But in Uganda, too, there are tens of different teachers' unions. And the other statistic that's useful is that if you want to impose sanctions on a teacher, the whole process takes 4 years on average, which means that they basically have given up. And in countries like Benin, where you have 30 teachers' unions, the inspectors, the school inspectors, have to get the permission of the teachers' union in order to inspect the school. But this is only one of the problems, the absenteeism, and it's as I was saying, it's a symptom of a problem. It's not the problem itself. The other is there are some studies showing that there's a lot of leakage of the resources going to primary schools. And there was a famous study done in Uganda in the mid-1990s that asked the question, you know, for how much of non-wage recurrent spending or recurrent costs that is intended for primary schools actually reaches the school. And the answer was something of the order of 13% on average. Now, there's some good news there that I'll get to in a minute. But I think there's an even more fundamental problem than leakage. And that is that the resources for public education get captured by the non-poor for higher education. Because higher education is something that both, this is the school leaving exam or the higher education exam that Abhijit was referring to, gets you access to prestigious, free and prestigious higher education. So the poor and the non-poor are lobbying for it, and they win. And guess who wins? One simple example of that is you look at the share of public sector, the share of public finances in the total cost of education. at its highest for higher education, for tertiary education. It's higher than for primary education. So the public sector is actually spending more than the private sector for higher education, which is benefiting the non-poor, than it is the primary education. This is a widespread phenomenon in Africa. If you just ask the question, what is the percentage of public resources going to the 10% most educated in the society, the average is 40%, 43%. And in countries like Malawi, it's of the order of 70%. I think in Malawi, the figure I remember reading was something like 53% of total resources in public resources in education goes to the richest quintile for higher education. It's over half is captured by them. I think Bob Prouty used to work in Senegal. I mean, the student unions, if you think the teachers' unions are powerful in primary school, you got to deal with the student unions in universities. And I remember once I was giving a series of lectures at University Cheikh Anta Diop in Senegal, and the students went on strike, and I didn't think it was because I was giving lectures. But the reason was that they were no longer getting access to individual dormitory rooms, that they had to share rooms across, and that was enough to put them on strike. And I noticed that the dean was talking to me and said, you know, Shanta, you used to be a professor at Harvard. Do the students at Harvard have individual dorm rooms? And I said, no, you know. But somehow they thought it was worth going on strike for. Now, what do we do in this situation? So the basic point is that we're stuck in this low-level equilibrium, where politically it's very difficult to change the system, but we know the system isn't working for the poor. And very quickly, I just want to talk about two sort of categories of solutions. One is actually to increase the power of parents, increase the possibility that parents and the children themselves can choose the school. And just give you one example from Bangladesh. There's a very interesting program in Bangladesh which has two components to it. It's a girls' scholarship program to encourage girls to go to secondary school, provided that the girl is enrolled in the school. And it could be any kind of school, a private school, a public school, a madrasa, an NGO-run school. And the school gets its stipend based on the number of girls who are enrolled. So it's like a voucher scheme, where the schools have an ability, have an incentive to attract the students. And as you can see, secondary school enrollment is rising very fast in Bangladesh, and it's rising twice as fast for girls as for boys. And you can see that there have been improvements in quality. You know, the public schools now have separate latrines for girls and boys, or they're hiring female teachers in order to attract the girls in there. So one category of students of solutions is giving choice. The second category, and Abhijit referred to this as well, is information, providing information. And let me just tell you the story of Uganda. Remember I mentioned in Uganda there was only 13% of the money that was intended for primary schools actually arrived at the school. Well, it turns out that the follow-on survey 5 years later showed that it was up to about 90% reaching the primary school. Now, how did this happen? It wasn't some fancy World Bank project, right? They did one simple thing when that initial survey was revealed, which is they published it in the newspaper. When they published it in the newspaper, it created a kind of movement where people started demanding how much money was coming to their district every month. And sure enough, they had to start increasing the amount of money coming to the district, and then very soon, parents started demanding how much what the teachers were doing with the money that was arriving in the school, now that they knew how much was coming. And they actually, now in Uganda, you have to post the school budget on the schoolroom door so that everybody can see it when they drop the kids off. But before, lest we get too excited about this information, because it's a seductive idea, let me actually allude to some work that Abhijit and some of my colleagues at the World Bank have been doing, which is that, you know, we're also assuming that these poor people have the time to absorb this information and make decisions. And these are people who are working night and day trying to make ends meet. And we have to have a perspective on the limits to which information can solve all of these problems. There's a very interesting study in Uttar Pradesh, in Jaunpur, the same district that Abhij is referring to, where they have a system, a village education committee that is supposed to distribute resources for improved curriculum and so on. And it'd been working for about 10 or 11 years. And then they went and did a study to see whether anybody had even heard of the VEC. This was the information that was there for the villagers to make use of. And it's something like 92% had never heard of the VEC. Of the remaining 7 or 8% that had heard of the VEC, 5% of them could not even name a single member of the Village Education Committee. And this included people who were themselves members of the Village Education Committee, right? So keep in mind that these solutions are extraordinarily complex and no simple solution like information or choice can solve it. So this is a balancing act. We introduce government into, we have a government intervention in education because there are market failures, inefficiency, and equity. But what we're observing is deep government failures in trying to solve those problems. Doesn't mean, and I fully agree with what Abhijit said, that the issue is not to go back to some private school, but it is a question of balancing these failures against each other so we can actually improve the welfare of those children that Jody spoke about. Thanks.